Guardian Unlimited.
The Second Fest Festival and Second Life starts today, produced by The Guardian and Intel. See the Pet Shop Boys, Groove Armada, and many more acts live. Go to guardian.co.uk/secondfest to find out more.
Hello, it's John Dennis here with News Desk on Friday, June the 29th. Today, as a terrorist attack on London is foiled, a stark reminder of the challenges facing the new government and the Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Jackie Smith started her first day in the job of Britain's first female Home Secretary, chairing a meeting of COBRA, the government's emergency response team. Also today, the Libyan man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing has won the right to appeal for the second time. We'll hear from some hardened smokers as they prepare for some tough new restrictions on lighting up in public, and we'll hear some tantalising details of The Simpsons movie. Ros Taylor's here in the pod with some details of today's papers. A car bomb was defused this morning in Piccadilly in the heart of London's West End. Police have searched some of the other landmark sites in the capital in case there are more explosive devices. Detectives have just held a press conference and Vikram Dodd was there for The Guardian. Vikram, what can you tell us about this car bomb?
This was a car which was parked outside a nightclub called Tiger Tiger in Haymarket in Leicester Square. There would have been hundreds of people around. Well, Peter Clark has just briefed me just about 1 o'clock in the morning. A London ambulance crew were called to the area just to treat someone coincidentally and notice what seemed to them to be smoke coming from inside the vehicle. The police called, the explosive officers come with them and think, okay, this is not just smoke coming out of the car. A further examination of the vehicle, which is a green Mercedes, shows there's significant quantities of petrol and gas cylinders and also a large number of nails. The petrol is contained in several containers. No quantities of that amount of petrol is given, and the device is disabled by explosives officers. And there appears to be some sort of detonation mechanism. What the police are saying at this stage is that obviously this is early days. They probably know them more than they're letting on, but that this potentially could have caused serious injury or loss of life. They're gathering lots of CCTV, which would be, there'll be a lot of CCTV coverage in that area.
Do we know anything at all, Vikram, about who might be behind this?
No, police are not publicly saying anything about who might be in it, but all the fingers will point towards Islamicist terrorism. One elliptical reference by Deputy Assistant Commissioner Peter Clark, who's the head of Scotland Yard's Anti-Terrorism Command, was that there are facets of the apparent device and apparent attack that have resonance with other plots we know about. So, for instance, gas cylinders and the use of gas cylinders in a car resonates with an Al-Qaeda plot by a guy called Duren Barrott, who was convicted recently and sentenced in the end to 30 years. The use of other facets of this apparent device resonate with other attacks. For instance, the targeting of nightclubs has strong resonance to what we call the Crevice trial, which was also known as a fertilizer plot, which saw several people convicted earlier this year. So in a sense, if you're looking at the MO of this, the techniques used, there is some resonance to past Al-Qaeda-inspired attacks or attempted attacks on the UK. At this stage, they're not saying definitively. I mean, at this stage, Scotland Yard, you know, they've got media attention, all the eyes of the world are on them. Their first job is trying to make sure there's as many witnesses as possible coming forward. They've got that, and they'll, at this stage, tread very slowly in terms of what they say on camera about what they suspect. You know, at this stage, the obvious questions, if you're looking at this from a national security point of view, is, you know, is this the start of something? Are we going to see other attacks? And at this stage, everything that's coming back is maybe, maybe not. Not ruling anything in, not ruling anything out. I think it's going to be the watchword or the phrase that you're going to hear quite a lot over the coming hours.
Vikram Dodd. The new Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, said today's incident reminds us that Britain faces a serious and continuous threat and that we need to be alert at all times. Patrick Winter is The Guardian's political editor. I asked him if Brown is likely to deal with threats to our security in a similar way to Tony Blair.
It's going to be a fascinating moment, just politically, putting aside the security side of it. I mean, Tony Blair is develops a reputation for being very good in these kinds of crises. And one of the question marks we always had about Gordon Brown was how he would adapt to events. He made it very clear at the start of his premiership he was going to be strong and resolute. He was going to be a security prime minister. It's also a baptism of fire for his new Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, who had, I think, got a call very early this morning telling her that this had occurred.
And security is very much the focus of the new slimmed-down Home Office, isn't it?
There's also a more streamlined operation going to be working inside the Cabinet Office, but it's true the Home Office has lost responsibility for prisons, is no longer responsible for constitutional reform.
Tony Blair was often criticised by civil liberties campaigners for the way he dealt with security issues. Do you think that Gordon Brown may face some of the same criticisms?
Well, I don't think it's necessary that there's got to be a new panoply of laws immediately as a result of this kind of activity. We just simply don't know enough about who was responsible. It's clear that Gordon Brown is intending to extend the period of detention that people can have without trial, but that he would add greater judicial oversight.
Looking at his government, what should we read into the inclusion of some sceptics and opponents of the Iraq war?
Well, I think the most striking appointment was of Mark Malik Brown, because, I mean, some of his remarks have been pretty outlandish in terms of the normal diplomatic behaviour, former Deputy Secretary of the UN, in terms of how he's discussed America and their role in Iraq. He's saying it's made it impossible, for instance, for there to be any kind of military intervention in Darfur, the area which he'll have direct responsibility for. So he's in a really striking appointment. John Denham is interesting in the sense that he opposed the war at the time and resigned. And in terms of David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, I mean, his opposition to the war is not publicly out there, but it's something he's discussed in private. He wasn't in the Cabinet at the time. And I don't think anyone it means there's going to be any kind of immediate withdrawal from Iraq.
Gordon Brown's Cabinet is scheduled to meet today to discuss restoring trust in British politics. What constitutional reforms has Brown got up his sleeve?
He believes that there is a real issue about trust, and that rather than being a great sort of lurch in one direction or another in terms of policy away from where Tony Blair was, there is an issue of trust that has to be addressed, and ultimately that has to be the way in which ministers behave, whether you can clamp down on spin such as it has described, or whether you can also start to give Parliament greater power over the executive. Beyond that, there's another wave of issues like House of Lords reform, and whether you could involve the public in any way in any kind of discussion about constitutional change, and whether there should be a Bill of Rights.
Has Gordon Brown fulfilled his pledge to create a government of all the talents?
There are going to be some unusual faces around in Whitehall, including businessmen, Liberal Democrats, and I think there'll be some sports figures. But it's not quite the sort of revolution that it was predicted at the start, and certainly the failure to get Paddy Ashdown into the Cabinet must have been a setback for him, because he had him down to become Northern Ireland Secretary. He's ended up instead with a former Conservative, Sean Woodward, who's going to do the job free of charge.
Patrick Winter. Now, Ross Taylor's here with today's papers. Ross, what do the papers make of the new Cabinet?
I have to say, there's a bit of a sense of anti-climax today, John. The FT says that it's the fate of Cabinet reshuffles to seem most interesting before they happen. And I do have the feeling that this is less than a thrilling reshuffle. In fact, The Guardian calls it a recalibration, which probably sums it up quite well. There are fewer women in the Cabinet, of course, about the same number of Scots, about the same number who went to Oxbridge. In some ways, it hasn't changed. So the average age has fallen to 49. But the appointment the newspapers are probably most interested in is that of David Miliband, the 41-year-old, to the Foreign Office. Of course, he is the man who some people urged to stand against Gordon Brown, who decided not to, and now it seems has been rewarded with a fairly big job, although one where, of course, he's going to be abroad a lot and therefore will be unable to do a lot of the Westminster plotting that has to precede any kind of bid for the leadership. So that could be quite a canny move. Nonetheless, a lot of people are tipping him for the next Prime Minister, when, as Telegraph suggests, people become bored with Gordon Brown's brand of politics.
And there was another stark reminder of the challenges facing Gordon Brown yesterday. Three British soldiers died in Basra.
The Mail and the Independent both splash with that news. Yes, and two of the soldiers actually came from Gordon Brown's constituency in Scotland, which both papers point out makes it all the more pressing that he gives a lead on Iraq and makes it clear when and how British troops are going to be withdrawing.
Detectives in Portugal investigating the disappearance of the British girl Madeleine McCann have arrested two people.
This is an Italian man and his Portuguese girlfriend. They both live in Spain, and according to the Times, they were both wanted by French police anyway. It turns out, according to the Sun, that the Italian man has a conviction for child abuse. He's he was convicted in 2004 for keeping the daughter of his Portuguese girlfriend in a darkened room and binding her hands with sticky tape. Now, it's not entirely clear what they may be charged with, but it turns out it does seem that they have been trying to extort money from Madeleine McCann's parents by claiming that they know where Madeleine is.
And British hopes at Wimbledon, such as they were, have been dashed.
Indeed, no surprises there. Tiger Tim, I'm afraid, left the scene yesterday after all that excitement of him beating someone quite skilled in the first round. Meeting someone, yes. He gave the Times calls a departing volley to the press yesterday. He said, "For years we've been far too accepting of mediocrity," which I must admit made me laugh out loud. But anyway, the other British sort of semi-hope, Katie O'Brien, also crashed out yesterday. So we now have no chance of winning Wimbledon whatsoever. No changes there. It does, though, give the papers a chance to concentrate on the real objects of interest, which, of course, are the female players' knickers. The Mail yesterday was very excited about a woman called Tatiana Golovin. Yes, that is her surname.
Shouldn't laugh at these foreign people's names, though, should we?
No. Who had taken to wearing scarlet knickers. And the Mail and Sun had even taken to calling them the lucky red knickers. But unfortunately for everyone, they turned out to be not so lucky yesterday because she too lost her game. So there will be no more red knickers. But the Sun is keen to show that it doesn't take red knickers to get into the Sun. And there are plenty of pictures of women wearing white knickers today too.
As our minds go back to 1997, Rosa, which they have been doing this week with the departure of Tony Blair from Number 10, a timely reunion of the Spice Girls.
A very timely reunion, and they are about to go on a big world tour, and they lined up in London yesterday to be sized up by the press to check on just how much they'd aged. There was a lot of attention, it has to be said, given to Victoria Beckham's chest, which is considerably larger than it appeared to be in 1997, and really quite perfectly formed. Even The Guardian comments on just how spherical her assets are. The Sun has a little bit of a pun on, of course, their most famous song, Wannabe. I really, really want a bigger, big bra on the front page. But everyone, there's a...
You did that very well.
Thank you. There's something quite... There's a good vibe about this time. The Guardian says that there's something hugely infectious about the band's chutzpah, even 10 years on.
Roz, many thanks. Don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap, our daily email service, guardian.co.uk/wrap. A second appeal has been granted in the case of Ali Mohamed Al-Megrahi, convicted of the murder of 270 people in the Lockerbie bombing. The way the original trial of Al-Megrahi was conducted is under fresh scrutiny, as The Guardian Scotland correspondent Severin Carell reports.
The decision by the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission to refer Al-Megrahi's conviction back to court for a fresh appeal was welcomed by Tony Kelly, the Libyan's lawyer. He was particularly pleased by the Commission's detailed criticisms of the original court's decision to rely heavily on contradictory testimony from a key witness, a Maltese shopkeeper called Tony Gauci. Mr. Gauci had told police Al-Megrahi resembled the customer who brought clothes later found at the crash site. And the Commission's criticisms of Mr. Gauci's evidence undermined the entire conviction, Mr. Kelly said.
I'm relieved that eventually this time waiting for the decision has come to an end. They've had the application for in excess of 3.5 years. And now we know that the appeal can progress before the High Court of Justiciary. So that's the overwhelming sense, I think, that my client and I have, that we're moving onwards and upwards, really, to the High Court of Justiciary.
Were you surprised at the level of detail that the Commission gave today, but also the fact that they were so critical, not only of the judges in the original trial, but also revealing that there had been evidence suppressed?
Not entirely. First of all, the length of time that they've had and the resources they've devoted to it meant that we were always going to get a very sort of chunky volume and a very detailed analysis of what occurred at the trial. their view in relation to the particular submissions that were made over 3 years ago now to them really doesn't come as any surprise whatsoever.
The Commission, however, has appeared to have dismissed several of the better-known arguments criticising the conviction and settled only on the evidence about Tony Gauchi's identification of Al-Megrahi. Does that affect your case to the appeal court?
Not in the slightest. If anything, it clears the field, really. It deals with the allegations about evidence tampering and puts them completely to one side, and it means that the appeal is not cluttered with any of those overblown statements about what happened actually in the investigation of the crime.
What do you think the Commission's most significant finding is?
That the court arrived at an unreasonable verdict in respect of the evidence of Tony Gauchi.
Dr. Jim Swire, whose daughter Flora died on board Pan Am Flight 103, said he was delighted the case was again being investigated by a Scottish court. He has had serious doubts about the safety of the original conviction ever since the trial ended in January 2001. All the Lockerbie relatives needed to know was who planted the bomb, he said.
The prosecution case was complex. It said that this Libyan put the bomb on board in Malta, that it then changed planes at Frankfurt and then at Heathrow onto the big plane to go transatlantic. Their case depended absolutely upon him having had a timer which could run for that long. Yet the plane exploded 40 minutes after leaving the tarmac at Heathrow. And that is, for a start, very peculiar, because why would a man with a timer like that choose to allow it to happen over land? Why would he risk, with the changes of flight and the delays that often happen in December, why would he risk it so close when he could have set the wretched thing to go off over mid-Atlantic if such a thing had been used? But what the court also heard was there was a Syrian group which had invented a very different type of bomb, which had fixed timers, and invariably these devices were stable at ground level for weeks or days or whatever you wanted, but they would always explode around 40 minutes after takeoff because they had an air pressure sensitive switch inside. And the fact that the Lockerbie plane blew up exactly when one of those devices would have gone off had one of them been put on board immediately made me think, what on earth is going on here? And there is a very much simpler explanation, namely that Iran was seeking revenge by using the Syrians as their surrogates, and that that was how it was done. And from then on, I could not believe the story, and further evidence later reinforced my view.
Jim Swire, whose daughter died on Pan Am Flight 103. Yesterday on Newsdesk, Severin heard from Robert Black QC, who devised Al-Megrahi's trial in the Netherlands. And you can still listen to that interview at guardian.co.uk/podcasts. The Simpsons TV series has been with us for 18 years. For almost as long, there have been rumours of a feature-length film. Next month, The Simpsons Movie finally reaches our cinemas, and The Guardian's Oliver Berkman has had an exclusive preview. Well, he's seen about 10 minutes of it in a high-security screening in Los Angeles. And he's also spoken to The Simpsons creators, including Matt Groening.
A scene that they're very, very proud of that involves Bart Simpson skateboarding naked, which they were very worried they might not be able to get past the film certifiers. And it takes on some pretty big themes. It's about environmentalism and global warming and religious fundamentalism, as well as people banging their heads.
To paraphrase Homer Simpson, The Simpsons does work on so many different levels, doesn't it?
That is the key quality that has kept it going. It's not only that different ages can understand different things, so that you can recruit a whole audience of 4- and 5-year-olds because of Homer Simpson falling down at the same time as you're satirising the American electoral process or whatever. It's also because adult viewers like both those things, the slapstick and the sophisticated stuff. And you can see a lot of that in the cartoons that that owe their existence to The Simpsons, most obviously South Park, I'd say.
Will The Simpsons movie have the same production values as the cartoon, or will it look more like a movie?
It does look a bit more like a movie. There's a lot of challenges. Spoke to a few of the animators involved, and there are a lot of challenges when the screen is that big.
And do you think the gags will keep coming thick and fast throughout the length of the movie?
Yeah, I mean, you talk to these guys, and that is the one thing that they are really, really dogmatic about and will get quite offended about if you sort of suggest it might be otherwise, which is no matter how much they're satirising stuff or how many big points they're making or how much of a story arc they've got going on, it's the rate of gags that they've got to sort of keep up. And Matt Groening, who I interviewed for this piece, the creator of The Simpsons, told me about, kicking jokes around 350 times and then deciding on the 351st time that actually it has stopped being funny, so it doesn't make it through into the script. I think the threshold is probably a lot higher.
The Simpsons has been going for 18 years or thereabouts. Mm. It's been going since the late 1980s when it first appeared in the Tracy Ullman show. How has it managed to keep going for so long?
Well, I think a big part of it is that thing about the multi-layers, because you get to have a young audience. There are animators working on The Simpsons now who I spoke to, who are one woman who's 30, 31, I think, who grew up with it as a kid and remembers it in Germany, where she comes from, when she was, what, you know, just very little. Then there's also this framework. It's an extremely strict framework. The fact that every storyline has to resolve by the end, the fact that nobody can develop or change like they would do in a soap opera or lots of dramas. The baby Maggie has learnt one word in the course of 20 years. And because of that strict framework, it means that actually huge numbers of writers can come in and add their ideas, their gags, I spoke to Ricky Gervais for this piece because he guest wrote an episode a little while ago, and he's really they're working within quite a fixed thing, and it's getting that form. Once you get that formula right, you know, I think you can bring all sorts of people to it and keep injecting it with new energy.
Why has it taken him so long to make a film?
I think it's taken this long because they just needed to get to a point where they had the core original team in a position to make something like this. And also, you know, they needed to get a move on because there are various contractual reasons where they need to get the voice artists to do it before their contracts risk expiring.
Oliver Berkman. And you can read a feature on the Simpsons movie by Oliver in Saturday's Guardian Weekend magazine, which has exclusive Simpsons artwork on its cover. On Sunday, smoking in enclosed public spaces will be banned. The new law covers offices, factories, pubs and bars. Smokers can still puff away outdoors or in their homes, but health correspondent Polly Curtis met some of the poor devils in an area of Hull that boasts the highest rate of smoking in Britain.
In Brantholme East, 54% of people smoke, 27% of pregnant women smoke through their pregnancy, and in the pubs I visited, I was hard pushed to find a non-smoker. I began by asking the local GP, Dr. AJ Kumar Chowdhury, his experience of the health impacts in this area.
Yes, I'm now a GP here since 1994, and I do see a lot of people with cigarette-related, for example, chronic bronchitis, cough and cold, and anything, you name it, and you see it. Incidence of chest infection is quite common, and COPD in asthma is quite common. Recently, public health from the Hull published a document, and we see it, that if you live in East Hull, your life is average 3 years less than when you live in Richmond. Smoking, it is 50% above the national average. Mm-hmm. And smoking among the teenagers, 32% of the girls, 15 and 16, they smoke. I find quite a lot of teenagers who are pregnant, they smoke.
I understand, 27% of all women who smoke through their pregnancy.
Yeah. And it caused a lot of stillbirth, miscarriage, and even the cord death.
I spent lunchtime in the Fordyke pub on the Friday before a bank holiday, and it was packed out with people with opinions on the ban. I asked landlady Linda Wild what she thinks of the ban.
They're going to be quite lenient to start with, but that puts us in a funny position because we're getting paperwork saying they're not allowed to smoke, you must tell them to go outside, you might get fined. On the other hand, they're saying they're going to be lenient, so what do you tell your bar staff?
Are you a smoker?
I am, but I'm hoping to stop, actually. It'll do me good.
Yeah.
Because all the smoke rises upstairs all the time. Your clothes stink even when you've washed and ironed them and everything. But I am a smoker, yes. And it's going to be quite hard to sit down and not have a cigarette when you've had a drink.
Yeah. And so what do your regulars think?
Well, they're all quite upset about it, really. But I just say there's nothing I can do. It's everywhere in England.
Atrocious. I think it's stupid.
Then why is it stupid?
Because this pub, 99% of people in this pub smoke.
Yeah.
So where are they going to go?
Where are you going to go? What are you going to do?
Don't come in. Buy cans, 50 pence a can, aren't they?
It's not going to be sociable no more, that's what it's all about, really.
But you don't smoke?
I'm a non-smoker, yeah, that's right. But I don't mind sitting with my friends if they smoke.
It should be a choice, shouldn't it? If you don't like smoking, don't come in the pub. If you're in an eating house, I agree with that. If you're in an eating house, don't smoke. On an aeroplane, don't smoke, because they'll just kill all the pubs.
Do you think you could give up smoking?
I don't want to.
No.
It's my choice.
I mean, it's really difficult. What am I supposed to do if you get 12? 15 stone rock women in the old late cigs.
Excuse me.
Today's edition of News Desk was produced by Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
The Second Fest Festival in Second Life starts today, produced by The Guardian and Intel. See the Pet Shop Boys, Groove Armada, and many more acts live. Go to guardian.co.uk/secondfest to find out more.
Guardian Unlimited.